Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killing, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch the murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out there fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we are delving into the third category of episodes that make up the basis of the science of murder, the criminal profiles. Criminal profiling as a science in and of itself will be a topic of a later episode, but today's episode will be dedicated to discussing the history and profile of a convicted serial killer, John Wayne Gacy, and all of the efforts that went into convicting him. Did you know that the fear of clowns is known as coulrophobia? I personally don't have that phobia, but it seems pretty common. It even makes a cultural appearance in the Sims franchise with the tragic clown, a figure that tries to cheer the characters up, only to leave them more depressed. That's an apt description for Gacy if I ever heard one, who became colloquially known as the Killer Clown. In the world of The Sims, the tragic clown is a glitch in the happiness of the neighborhood. In 1970 Chicago, John Wayne Gacy was that glitch. He wasn't just a man in face paint. He was a precinct captain, a contractor, and a pillar of the community who used those titles to mask a predatory hunger. But as any scientist knows, you can only mask a biological reality for so long. Eventually, the unexplained smells and the missing PDM employees became a trail that even his political influence couldn't hide. The years between 1942 and 1963 formed the biological and psychological foundation of what would become a triple life. This period defines the foundation of Gacy's life, balancing a rising professional reputation with an escalating, violent internal drive. Born in Chicago, his childhood was marred by a strained relationship with a volatile, alcoholic father who served as the primary architect of Gacy's deep-seated insecurities. In the lab, we look for the precursor to a reaction. For Gacy, that precursor was a household where masculinity was defined by aggression and vulnerability was punished. He wasn't just a troubled kid. He was a boy learning to build a high-functioning facade to survive an environment that offered no safety. His father frequently ridiculed him, questioning his manhood and mocking his physical health issues, such as the heart condition that sidelined him from traditional sports. This early environmental molding created a man who viewed his own internal world as a stain that needed to be hidden, reinforced, and eventually corrected through the bodies of others. By the time he reached his early 20s, the blueprints were finalized. On the surface, Gacy was proving to be a high-functioning member of society. A man who could climb the corporate ladder at the Nunnbush Shoe Company and manage employees with an ease that masked his internal friction. But beneath the rising professional reputation, the vicious hubris was already beginning to ferment. He was learning how to play the role of the model citizen while the internal war over his identity became a silent ticking metronome setting the stage for the literal graveyard he would eventually build in the 1970s. In 1964, Gacy moved to Waterloo, Iowa, where the model citizen persona was perfected. He became a successful KFC franchise manager, a workaholic who used the fast-paced environment to demand absolute control over his employees, a clear precursor to his later management style at PDM Contractors. His social rise was equally rapid. He became a high-ranking member and vice president of the Waterloo Jaycees, getting his first taste of the Pillar of the Community Shield. It taught him a dangerous lesson. If you perform enough public good, the world will ignore the private smell of your character. However, the mask slipped in 1968 when he was convicted of sodomy involving a teenage boy. Sentenced to 10 years, he served only 18 months, paroled in 1970 as a model prisoner. After his release, Gacy returned to Chicago in 1971, where he married Carol Hoff and moved into 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. It was the final piece of the model citizen puzzle, a suburban home with a hidden earthen void beneath the living room floor. He also established his own business, PDM, painting, decorating, and maintenance contractors, utilizing the business as a recruitment tool for young men and boys. Shortly thereafter, on January 2, 1972, the Tragic Clown officially became the Killer Clown. Gacy lured his first victim, 15-year-old runaway Timothy McCoy, from a bus station using his helpful contractor persona. After the murder, Gacy established a chilling forensic marker. He buried McCoy in the crawl space of his home, where he resided with his wife. While Timothy McCoy buried beneath the floorboards under his own home, Gacy didn't retreat into the shadows. Instead, he leaned harder into the light. He became a precinct captain, a business owner, and eventually the clown. He didn't just kill. He immediately sought to hide the evidence beneath the floorboards of his model life, beginning a 6-year period of living directly above his victims. But while Pogo was entertaining the neighborhood, the crawl space was beginning to fill. The Tragic Clown wasn't just a glitch anymore. He was a predator with a contractor's license. For me, as a person and a scientist, the most disturbing part of this timeline isn't just the murder. It's the cohabitation. Gacy spent the next 6 years hosting parties, sleeping, and eating just inches above a growing collection of human remains. This wasn't just a disposal site, it was a vault that he managed with the same meticulous, yet eventually lazy, oversight he applied to his construction jobs. From 1972 to 1978, Gacy's public persona reached its peak while his home became a literal graveyard. He didn't just live a double life, he lived a triple one. To the neighborhood, he was the pillar of the community, a Democratic precinct captain who threw massive turkey block parties. To the local children's hospitals, he was Pogo the Clown. But to the young men of Chicago, he was a predatory employer. He utilized PDM contractors as a biological filter, specifically selecting those who were transient or estranged from their families. He was a man who understood that in the 1970s, a runaway was a file that police would eventually abandon, allowing him to operate with a terrifying level of structural science. Gacy's most effective tool of subjection wasn't a weapon, it was a performance. He would frequently invite guests or potential victims over and show off his handcuff trick. He would place the cuffs on the individual, claiming he had a secret escape method used by magicians, only to reveal that he held the only key. It was a literal performance of entrapment disguised as entertainment. This was the tragic clown in its most predatory form, using the appearance of a trick to strip a victim of their agency before they even realized they were in danger. From a behavioral science perspective, we have to look at the why, the internal engine driving the machine. A prominent hypothesis among profilers is that Gacy was fueled by internalized homophobia. He was a man at war with his own identity, viewing his attractions not as a preference, but as a biological stain that he couldn't scrub away. His violence functioned as a reactive strike against the very thing he loathed in himself. By murdering these young men, he was attempting to kill his own perceived vulnerabilities. And let's be honest, Gacy wasn't just correcting a perceived moral failure. He was clearly enjoying the overtime. There's a specific kind of smugness in a man who uses a magic trick to handcuff a boy just so he can spend the next hour playing judge, jury, and executioner. For Gacy, the humiliation of his victims was the ultimate model citizen perk. However, Gacy didn't just want victims, he wanted props. His crimes were highly choreographed, and a clinical look at his history shows that Gacy became dangerously enraged when others didn't play their assigned roles. If a boy resisted or questioned the trick, the model citizen mask shattered. It's the ultimate irony, isn't it? For a guy who spent his life building things, houses, political connections, a persona, he had zero tolerance for anyone who wouldn't fit his blueprints. The moment a victim went off script, Gacy's high-functioning engine would redline into a total meltdown. He didn't just want to kill them, he wanted to delete them for ruining his performance. We see this in the overkill or the physical evidence of struggle. While Gacy preferred the efficiency of his rope trick strangulation, the moments where he lost control reveal a man who couldn't handle a reality he didn't dictate. It was during this period that Gacy refined his MO. He didn't just use a ligature, he used a piquet, a mechanical windlass technique also referred to as the Spanish windlass. By inserting a stick into a rope or cloth ligature and twisting, he could apply massive, steady pressure. This is a way to achieve asphyxiation with minimal physical struggle. It was an engineering solution that allowed him to maintain his clinical distance while exerting total control. He wasn't just correcting these boys. He was punishing them for the ultimate sin in his world, autonomy. If you didn't play the rule, you were a defect in his perfect system. And Gacy, the contractor, knew exactly what to do with the defective materials. He discarded them. They were simply debris to be cleared away so the project of his life could continue. He didn't just bury them. He tucked them into the foundation of his model life, where he thought they would never be found. Gacy, like every predator, eventually suffered from the vicious hubris of thinking he was untouchable. His downfall wasn't a complex forensic breakthrough. It was the simple mistake of recruiting too close to home. On December 11, 1978, 15-year-old Robert Peace told his mother, who was waiting for him in the car outside a drugstore, that he was going to speak to a contractor about a holiday job. That contractor was Gacy. Unlike the invisible runaways Gacy usually targeted, Peace had a family that was actively waiting for him. When Peace didn't return to the car, his mother didn't wait. She went to the police immediately. This was the moment the tragic clown mask finally cracked. Gacy had finally snatched someone whose absence created a roar rather than a whisper. Leading the Des Moines police directly to the door of 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. The disappearance of Robert Peace provided the investigative hook that finally allowed police to pierce Gacy's community leader shield. On December 13, 1978, police interviewed Gacy about Robert Peace. He nonchalantly claimed Peace never showed up. But during the interview, investigators noticed a yellow photo processing receipt in Gacy's trash. When Robert Peace had disappeared on December 11, 1978, he was wearing a parka he had borrowed from his coworker, Kim Byers. Earlier that shift, Kim had processed a roll of film and, without thinking, tucked the receipt from that film into the pocket of the parka. That receipt in Gacy's trash was the physical paper trail that placed the boy at the scene, effectively dismantling Gacy's alibi. From December 14th through 20th, the Des Plaines police placed Gacy under 24-hour surveillance. Gacy didn't just tolerate the police presence, he weaponized his hospitality. He would walk out to the officers' cars and offer them coffee or invite them into his home for drinks, treating the investigation like a social engagement. He even took them to his favorite restaurants, introducing the men tasked with catching him to his political and business associates. By doing this, he wasn't just being friendly. He was attempting to subsume the investigation into his model citizen narrative, testing whether his social capital was strong enough to neutralize their professional suspicion. The most chilling aspect was his introduction of Pogo. He showed the victors, the officers, his clown suits and photos of his charitable work, essentially saying, "How could a man who brings joy to sick children be capable of what you're suggesting?" It was a high-stakes gaslighting campaign. He was using a mask to mock the very men who were looking for the bodies he had hidden just a few feet away underneath his floorboards. However, while Gacy was playing the gracious host, the forensic reality was quietly mounting against him. While he was out at dinner with investigators, other teams were back at the station building the case against him. Gacy was a predator who had successfully navigated the system for so long that he believed the rules of evidence no longer applied to him. He was so busy performing the role of the pillar of the community that he failed to realize the police were no longer looking at his mask. They were looking at his trash. That shield finally shattered on December 21st, 1978, when a second search warrant was executed. Investigators immediately noticed the strong, swampy smell of decay. Upon entering the crawl space, they discovered human remains. When the first remains were unearthed, Gacy didn't immediately fold. Even as the model citizen shield shattered, Gacy's first instinct was to manage the damage by applying his corporate hierarchy to the crime scene. in a final desperate performance of the responsible employer persona, he attempted to blame his PDM employees. He claimed he was a victim of his own contractors, arguing that the young men he hired had committed the murders and utilized the crawl space without his knowledge. This attempt to delegate the guilt was his last stand as the pillar of the community. It was only after the physical evidence, the specific locations of the bodies, and his personal involvement with the victims became undeniable that his resolve broke. Gacy was arrested and began a marathon confession, admitting to the murders of 33 young men and boys. He had finally run out of people to manage and scripts to write. But the confession revealed a final desperate pivot in his MO. While 29 victims remained tucked into the foundation of his Summerdale home, the boy whose disappearance broke the case, Robert Peast, was no longer to be found. Gacy, the contractor, had finally run out of square footage. He admitted that when his vault reached capacity, he began discarding his defective materials into the Des Plaines River. He had transitioned from a burial to dumping, a sign that the biological reality of his crimes was finally outpacing his ability to manage the site. Gacy wasn't a chaotic monster. He was actually quite organized, just bad at following through after his murderous impulses were satisfied. His disposal techniques were convenient until they weren't. Eventually, even a contractor runs out of square footage, and the biological reality of what he left behind began to outpace his ability to hide it. Because Gacy prioritized convenience over concealment, he created what was arguably the most grueling phase for the forensic teams. To uncover the truth, they had to navigate a 3-foot-high, muddy crawl space to recover decades of commingled evidence. It wasn't just a crime scene, it was a physical manifestation of Gacy's failure to follow through. Throughout the winter of 1979, the investigators worked in a cramped environment that was both damp and acidic. Because the space was too low to stand in, the team, led by investigators like Clyde Snow, a pioneer in forensic anthropology, had to treat the crawl space like an archaeological dig. They established a string grid system dividing the dark 1,400 square foot space into manageable sections. In the lab, we know variables like volume, temperature, and humidity dictate the rate of decay. In the confined space of the Gacy home, these factors created a microenvironment that challenged the stability of the remains. In a crawl space, the high humidity acts as a catalyst for anaerobic bacteria, microorganisms that thrive without oxygen. The lack of oxygen, combined with the standing water from poor drainage, meant the bodies were essentially being processed by the environment for years. These conditions accelerated biological breakdown, leaving many remains in advanced stages of skeletal commingling, where the boundaries between one victim and the next had physically dissolved into the earth. Every bucket of mud had to be hand-sifted through screens to find small teeth, rings, or fabric fragments. This process was inadvertently managed by the house itself. The home's heating system sat directly above the crawl space. In the winter, the warmth from the furnace acted as a catalyst, accelerating the processing of the bodies. In the summer, the Illinois humidity peaked, trapped in the unventilated void. It turned the house into a biological furnace, making the cohabitation even more chilling. Gacy was literally living in the exhaust of his own crimes. Because many victims were runaways, ignored by the system, the lab was their last chance at an identity. Gacy's victims weren't just missing persons. They were the disappeared. Odontologists and radiologists worked to give names back to the boys Gacy tried to erase. But Gacy's system of disposal was a very effective way of stripping away identity that the work wasn't finished until 1979. In fact, it wouldn't be finished for decades. They relied on comparative radiography, matching the unique science cavities or dental work found in the mud to medical records from across the country. It was a slow clinical reconstruction of lives that had been reduced to a convenient storage solution. While many of the victims were identified quickly through this method, many remained John Doe's. It wasn't until 2011 that modern DNA analysis would finally give names back to a few more of the boys Gacy had discarded. But the case couldn't wait for the science of the future. With the identities that could be proven, the investigation was forced to move to the courtroom. As the last of the remains were cataloged and the Summerdale house was prepared for demolition, the investigation shifted from the mud of the crawl space to the forensic lights of the courtroom. The transition from evidence collection to trial was a move from the physical history written in the bone and fiber to the narrative history argued by attorneys. The legal conclusion of the case focused on the vicious duality of Gacy's mind, balancing the narrative of a monster against the clinical evidence of a calculated predator. While the defense sought to frame Gacy as a man fractured by internal chaos, the prosecution relied on the meticulous nature of the forensic recovery to prove a different story, one of a man who was fully in control of his convenient cruelty. Defense attorney Sam Amirante faced an uphill battle against 33 counts of murder. His strategy relied on the insanity or monster defense, arguing that Gacy was driven by multiple personalities and was unable to appreciate the criminality of his conduct. To the defense, Gacy was a biological glitch, a man whose mind had misfired into a murderous state. However, the prosecution used the very evidence we discussed previously to dismantle this claim. They argued that Gacy's behavior wasn't insane, it was tactical. The use of a magic trick to entrap victims, the calculated structural silence of selecting runaways, and the organized, if lazy, disposal of bodies in a localized vault suggested a man who understood exactly what he was doing. You don't hide 29 bodies under your own floorboards by accident. You do it because you believe you're smart enough to manage the risk. The jury spent less than 2 hours deliberating. They rejected the monster defense, finding Gacy sane and guilty of all 33 counts. It was a victory for the forensic method. The evidence under the floorboards spoke louder than the performance in a clown suit. At the time, it was the most convictions ever attributed to one person in U.S. history. Gacy spent 14 years on death row at Menard Correctional Center. Even behind bars, he continued his model citizen performance, painting his infamous clowns and maintaining his innocence in various media interviews. He remained mired in manipulation until his execution by lethal injection on May 10, 1994. The Summerdale home was demolished. It remains an empty lot today, a permanent spot on the Chicago landscape. It serves as a reminder that while Gacy tried to bury his victims in the dark, the scientific rigor of the identification process was what ultimately brought their names back into the light. In the lab, we often say that the body doesn't lie, but people do. The Gacy trial was the ultimate showdown between Gacy's lies and the undeniable truth of the forensic record. He wanted to be seen as a monster because monsters aren't held accountable. But the science proved he was just a man who made a series of very specific, very lethal choices. The details of this case aren't just stories. They are a record of a systemic failure and a forensic triumph. If you want to dive deeper into the documentation I used for today's case study, I highly recommend looking into Killer Clown by Terry Sullivan for the internal investigation perspective, The Man Who Killed Boys by Clifford Leindecker for the narrative of the victims Gacy tried to erase, and Defending a Monster by Sam Amirante for the unique legal perspective from the man who stood in the center of the storm. In the lab, we look at frequency and duration to understand a pattern. Gacy's pattern was a relentless metronome of violence. For 6 years, while he was attending political fundraisers and children's parties, he was adding a new spot to his crawl space roughly every 2 months. He wasn't just a killer, he was a high-capacity predator. In our next episode, we leave the damp, crowded soil of the Summerdale crawl space for the sterile, quiet precision of the medical ward. We move from a killer who used a construction business to hide his debris to those who used the very tools of healing to commit the ultimate betrayal. We will delve into the science of morphine and opioids. We'll discuss how this powerful alkaloid, once hailed as God's own medicine, became a signature tool for the angels of death. From the clinical pinpoint pupils of a toxidrome to the high-stakes chemistry of postmortem redistribution, we will see how the lab identifies a lethal overdose when the weapon is a substance already found in the hospital pharmacy. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found the recovery of the Summerdale house or the psychology of the killer clown fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Your reviews are the catalyst that helps other science-minded fans find the show. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Gacy's contractor persona or the forensic challenges of the crawlspace recovery. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. I'm Lissa, and thank you for joining me for this deep dive into the blueprints of a predator. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I'll see you in the toxicology lab for our next discussion.